requiring media professors to license clips for use in class would endanger academic freedom and diminish the educational experience for students. For these reasons, licensing cannot constitute an alternative to circumvention when the circumvention is completed for the purposes of teaching, scholarship, and research. Well, I understand the point of view. I think it's a legitimate point of view, but it's not the point of view of someone who has read and understood this statute. This statute says availability for non-infringing use. A permitted use is a non-infringing use. And if that's available, then that vitiates any need for the exemption. To the extent it is available, it vitiates that need. So after two rounds of submissions, 3 hours of live testimony, now, again, 5 minutes ago, Professor DeCherney gives us three anecdotes involving censorship, none of which involve classroom use. There is no record that censorship is a problem here. If there were a record, if he had asked if any of his of the hundreds of people who have signed on to his or organizations that have signed on to his submission had asked and been turned down on censorship grounds, I think we would have heard about it. But there is no record of that. The only record here, and it's, admittedly it's a limited one, is from Warner Brothers, which shows that even though these works might be presented in an unflattering manner, they've been granting permission. So I just don't think that's an issue.
Rich, you got something to add?
Well, just I really don't understand the concept of using not being able to repeat or copy someone else's speech as being censorship. I don't think that's how most courts have interpreted the First Amendment. We're talking about other people's speech here. So I just don't think it falls within censorship. I think the whole censorship argument is not relevant to this discussion.
Okay, it's 10 to 6, so I'm going to ask people to try to I don't want to take too much more time if we can avoid it. So I'm going to ask people to try to actually focus on the questions asked and to try to be very responsive to the questions and hopefully not use them as an opportunity to go off in some other direction, which 3 hours ago we might have been more than happy to explore, but right now let's see if we can try to get down the home stretch. Steve, one of the first things you said in this session was, and I may be slightly overstating what you said, that essentially all the kinds of uses that all the witnesses on this side of the room are talking about were uses that you certainly agree they should be able to do. I don't know that you said they're not infringing, but that was a flavor of what I heard from you. Now, I gather that includes the uses by students that we've been hearing about.
I'm not sure we were shown very many uses by students, but in fact, yes, I mean, the kinds of uses that were the general types of uses that we're talking about here without saying every single one of them that was in listed anywhere, but in general, these are non-infringing uses.
Okay, let's assume that we are where we were 3 years ago with respect to our state of mind about the exemption that was given at the instigation of, or at the request of Professor DeCherney. And let's assume, based on that we now look at a request for students, and at least some of those students are going to be Professor DeCherney students. At least some of them are going to be doing projects that are going to be on exactly the same kind of topics that he's lecturing on and that he persuaded us he needed to be able to circumvent CSS in order to get that pristine or near pristine copy to make the point he's trying to make. I would imagine that that at least some of the students on some of their projects would have exactly the same need. Is that maybe first I should ask Professor DeCherney to tell me whether I'm right about that, because if I'm not, then we can stop right here. So
you're absolutely right.
All right, confirmation. Wow. So assume that's the case. What do we do about the request that's on the table to have an exemption for students who are engaging in projects like this?
We have two main concerns about it. One is...
it's about students.
Well, I don't want to use the word exponential because I guess it's Jonathan thought it was bizarre. But in fact, I don't know the average class size of Professor DeCherney's sections, but let's say it's 20. So suddenly 20 times as many people have the ability to make this to circumvent under the exemption than had it 3 years ago. I think this really gets to Bruce's point. It starts to normalize the behavior, and in particular, I know Professor DeCherney is respected and admired by his students, but I don't think that he can control their activities, particularly outside his class, so that when they have if they had exercised the exemption to make a copy in the clear of an entire movie, because that's how this tool works, they then use the make clips, they compile clips and use them in the class in a non-infringing way, that's great, and they still have the copy in the clear on their computer. You know, I think it just blinks reality to say that it's the same difference, it's the same situation as Professor DeCherney having it on his computer, if 20 times Professor DeCherney have it on their on the student computer. So it just strikes us as a further undermining of the exemption of the prohibition, and one that I think the office needs to be extremely cautious about moving to, again, in light of the alternatives that are available.
Chris?
If you extend the exemption to students, why stop there? Why just students? Why not anybody?
You want to move over there?
Well, that was a rhetorical question. I didn't want an answer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because then you have a standard that you can circumvent any time you're making a fair use. And Congress could have...
Well, come on. That's not really... We're trying to find people in particular circumstances who have shown a particular need. We're not saying open it up to everybody.
But I think you are. When you extend it to students, you've drawn a line so far down the path that you're going to have a very hard time in 3 years saying, why did you stop at students? Why not anybody else that wants to engage in fair use? And then you have a standard that circumvention is okay if you're engaging in fair use. And that clearly was an issue in 1996 or 98 when this statute was being debated. A lot of people thought that should be the standard, mm-hmm. and some people still do, by the way. But it isn't. That's not the law. That cannot be the standard upon which you make your decision in this proceeding.
Can I ask a follow-up in terms of the scope? I mean, what do you feel then? I'm guessing you might know, and this is based on my experience with my son at high school. What do you think of the exemption extending to high school media studies as a class or as a subject for this exemption? What's your feelings about that?
I think you just made my point.
Well, that's what I was trying to figure out, because, you know, certain high schools have advanced classes.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to know what you felt about that.
I think you just heard.
I do.
Can I say, from my experience, students don't seem any more unethical or prone to illegal behavior than faculty.
Should we be encouraged or upset about that?
and by the admission of the reply commenters, I think it was the joint reply commenters, it may have actually been the MPA, you know, there are no known abuses of the exemption in the past 3 years. You know, you can multiply that by any number you want. I don't see why there should be more abuses by students. Talking about the size, I mean, it's still a very limited size. I'd like to say all the students at my university are majoring in cinema studies, my field. Unfortunately, it's actually a very small percentage, right? It's not even a large percentage of students engaged or enrolled in any university. If you go to University of Maryland, many of the universities don't even have the appropriate department for them to major in. And finally, this has come up a number of times, but it's something that's important to keep stating, is that 1201 exemption is not a license to violate copyright law or any other law. And so if a student has the full copy of a Hollywood film on their computer, they're not using it for any particular reason, they shouldn't have it there. They are clearly in violation of copyright law, and the same laws that would have kept them from doing it before, you know, would still apply.
Just one point about extending this to students wouldn't necessarily extend it to anyone. One of the things that I think that we have to focus on is the particular factors that the librarian has to consider, and one of those being that we focus specifically on nonprofit archival preservation and educational purposes, and that the effect of the prohibition on criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, or research. So at least when we're keeping within the realm of students and professors, I mean, it's one of the sort of more highly considered areas. Don't these factors place some kind of limitation on you know, where you give heavier weight to the consequences of the prohibition?
It could, but the question still is, where do you draw the line? High school students have a legitimate need to engage in commentary and all of these other fair use purposes. And in fact, individuals do, whether they're in school or not, may have occasion to do that. I think what Professor DeCherney just said is very telling. Why don't we just rely on the copyright law? And I think really that is the issue here, that they would like the world or the law to be that we rely on copyright law and circumvention should not be prohibited by anyone. But that is not what Congress did in 1998. Congress enacted a law that said circumvention should be prohibited. And that's the law. So whether people like it or not, that's the law. And I would hope that your decision in this review does not totally undermine that law, because if it does, you are certainly not following the will of the Congress.
But even going to the specifics of the law, if we go to Section 110.1, it doesn't just address educators or faculty. It's performance display of a work by instructors or pupils. So in going to just with basic copyright law and non-infringing uses, there seems to be many of these uses are dealing with in-class use by either or. So isn't that give us a basis of putting, perhaps extending that emphasis to students in 110.1? Yeah.
Well, again, we're not necessarily contesting that these are not, that the use, these could be non-infringing uses if made by students. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is what does it do to the integrity of the prohibition to go from a relatively small number of film and media professors to look at Ms. Hobbs' PowerPoint, 73,000 communication film majors. That's just the majors. I assume not everybody who takes one of Professor DeCherney's courses is majoring in it. And, of course, you can't major in it at the University of Maryland, I'm told, but obviously there are courses about it. In fact, there are 100 courses about it. Hundreds of thousands of other college students, 3.5 million high school dropouts, but I guess before they drop out, they would be able to take advantage of this exception. You know, at some point, this does start to add up, and we would just encourage you to be extremely careful about moving to broaden substantially the universe of people entitled to take advantage of this exemption.
Other paradox. Say you choose not to broaden it to include students. Say you say only film professors or only some group of professors. Then we're placed in a very unusual situation which says, do as I say, not as I do. I'm going to show you my, I've received this special exemption, but you can't do this. You are not entitled to the same privilege. Now that continues to erode confidence in copyright law. That continues to perpetuate that grab anything and go mentality. And that's the very reason why we're here. We want to help students make the distinction between pirating and fair use. And only by letting students in their own hands, with their own minds and their own energy, understand that distinction, can we expect to have law-abiding citizens in the 21st century.
Well, this isn't the only area of the law where some things are allowed to teachers and not allowed to students.
Okay, understood. Carlton?
And just part of the student consideration, as you think about it, is there's all sorts of different types of students, and let's not leave out the graduate student and the teaching assistant and the research assistant and the PhD student who, sometimes in a big university, is that person that appears to be the professor to the students who are in their class because they're doing the teaching. And they're also younger, more creative, more into the technology, and they know how to do a lot of the things that should be done for teaching, and they assist the professors, and they tell them about it, but they may be stuck in what to do about it once okay. In that situation.
Peter, and then we're going to move on.
I would just say I think it's possible to stay within the confines of 1201 and still open up a class that includes many disciplines and also students. You know, we're not saying it's all fair use. We've all conceded that there is a lot of fair use out there. A lot of it is being interrupted by circumvention or the inability to circumvent. But I think limiting both the class and the use and users really is a way of staying far within the confines of fair use and clearly not opening it up to everyone. The idea of using a library collection, I think, you know, is very useful in defining the class. These are DVDs and other forms of material that have been collected by a university, presumably because they have some value to the university for educational critical reasons. By confining it to institutions like universities, like schools, you're also defining the use and the users. And even though that may sound like everyone, you're sitting on that side of the room, it's people that are engaged in very specific tasks, and they're working towards education. I think they're on the side of right and the side of good, and it'd be valuable for them to have this kind of exemption.
Okay, we're going to move on to what will be my last question. I have two colleagues here who still may have some, but and this is to you, Steve. You pointed to your submission on page 30 where you suggest a number of conditions, one of them having to do with all existing digital editions or copies containing access controls that prevent making such compilations. And in your submission, or in your oral submission, you also made the point that essentially if there's a digital copy that's not controlled, that doesn't have access controls on it, then you shouldn't be able to circumvent CSS on some other digital copy. Well, that assumes something that I'm not sure I'm willing to assume, but I'm willing to be educated. That assumes that all digital copies are created equal. And is that really the case? I mean, we heard about YouTube. I think those copies on YouTube are digital copies. And yet I at least heard Brene assert something that makes sense to me, but I don't know, that you try to use one of those YouTube clips and put it up on a big screen, you're just not going to see something very good. So don't we have to be at least a little bit more nuanced than just say, if there's any digital copy out there that's in the clear, then you can't circumvent?
You're right that all digital copies are not created equal, and there are quality differences. So I think it does get back to the question of whether you are drawing a line on quality, or how clearly you're drawing the line on quality, and how many of the uses that you would be covering can be made. In other words, the pedagogical purposes can be met without circumventing CSS on a DVD. I think that's the test that you used last time, if I'm not mistaken. I think you said that the question was, are there alternative formats or methods that are the alternatives wholly insufficient for pedagogical purposes? Does the professor or the faculty member demonstrate what may only be revealed through use of the DVD version? I think that's an extremely small category, and I think for the vast majority of the uses that we're talking about and that we've been presented with and that we've seen demonstrated here, that quality is, while obviously preferable from the perspective of the faculty member, is not essential. It's not wholly insufficient for their pedagogical purposes to use something that may be of lower quality.
But if Professor Desherry needs to show Yoda's ears and all he has is a YouTube version, and that YouTube version is in the clear, as I read your proposal, he wouldn't be able, he'd have to use the YouTube version.
Well,
is that really where you want?
He could certainly do the camcorded version of the DVD of Yoda's ears. I think we have hopefully demonstrated that, or you'll look at the DVDs yourself. But no, there certainly are things that may need to be fine-tuned in this definition. We propose it as a starting point, though, to try to emphasize what you have emphasized in other exemptions, which is that if there are other comparable versions available that aren't don't require circumvention, use those. I agree that at some point one digital version may not be comparable to another digital version.
Okay. Well, it's
just to answer that question about the not only are there not all DVDs created equal. Not all distributors and rights holders are created equal as well. And in the university world, obviously we buy a lot of things from what are educational distributors in DVD format. And generally speaking, with educational distributors, you have someone to talk to, and their rights are pretty clear on their pages. their web pages and their instructions of what type of rights you get, even though most of them are not exactly the same what they're granting you. What they do do often, though, is for some extra price, maybe grant you other rights you need or don't need, generally in the realm of performance or digital rights. If you want to mount a video onto your server, they will grant that. Very rarely do any of their rights address the issue of this whole thing we're talking about today, the individual person doing clips. Most of the time, if you get to talk to somebody about it, you have people say, no problem. You have people that say, I can't do that. And it becomes a question of discussion and permission on that level. But, I mean, as an educational distributor, you do have a realm to talk to. You have a realm to work with it. But coming here today, some of those distributors were in support of the possibility of this type of exemption, but not all.
It is 6:08. I will turn to Ben and Chris with a caveat that it's 6:08.
And they work for you.
By all means, take all the time you need.
I have an 8-part question.
I just wanted to state for the record what, if any, and I know you might have said this in your comments, what harm has come to copyright owners with the exemption in place for the last 3 years? Anything at all?
I think it's very hard to judge. We have no way of telling how many people are using the clips and in what way they're using them and whether they're using them consistent with the exemption, actually. But, Steve, you may have more to say.
No, I think that's well put. It's rather opaque to us, but we don't have any documented cases of abuse to bring forward.
I think...
Nor do we.
Okay.
I'm shocked.
But you'll let us know.
Our concern is erosion of the principle that circumventing a technological measure is against the law. And if erosion occurs, it's going to take place probably slowly. And no matter what you do, we could probably never empirically prove harm. But over time, we would be harmed as more and more people feel that they have a right to circumvent and it's not against the law. That's what we're concerned about here. And at the end of the day, technological measures are what has enabled us to make our movies and television shows available to tens, hundreds of millions of people who never had them available before in the forms and with the convenience they now have. Maintaining the integrity of DRM is absolutely essential to our business and to the interest of consumers in having access to what we create. That's what we're trying to protect here.
I just had a brief clarifying question about permissions. And I know that, Ms. Astar, as you talked about business that you and the other studios are working with USC, where a requester would be given a download or a URL, a secure URL. What I'm curious about is when we're talking about circumvention, we're talking about permissions. Are we also envisioning a situation where someone would write to a movie studio and say, hi, I'd like to circumvent your DVD. Can I have permission for that? Or would it be, I'd like you to send me a DVD quality clip from this time code to this time code? I'm just kind of curious how that would work in practice. And I understand you haven't had many requests of this sort or any. But
on the USC Film Server project, the way that the service is contemplated is that the film professor would actually go on and browse the film and mark the clips with the player that he or she wished to use, and the service would automatically provide the professor with those clips, either by downloading them or giving them on a secure URL. So, I mean, you can call it a permission system because we're facilitating it, but there's no interaction with the studio, and everything is done directly by the professor on the server. With respect to our experience in terms of letters, again, it's not something that we often get. A request for a use in an educational context, and as I said earlier, and others from the education community probably know better. I suspect it's because there are people are getting access to those clips in other ways and making use of them in ways where they feel they don't need to contact us. The sorts of requests that we get are typically from people who say, we think it's a fair use, do you agree? And in those instances, our response is generally, we don't opine on whether it's a fair use or not, but we have no objection. So the one instance that I did submit where we were asked for a clip, we were told, this is the scene that we want, starting here, ending there, and our film lab was able to get that clip and attach it to a email and send it back to the professor who was requesting it. So,
if you had even a dozen such requests a week, I suspect you wouldn't be able to offer that kind of a service, could you?
I suspect that it would become burdensome at some point. Yes, but that's why I pointed to the fact that I really don't think that people should think of these no objection letters as some sort of new licensing scheme. They're what they are. They're a no objection letter. We're saying you've got either a classroom exemption that you can take advantage of, you have a fair use defense that you can take advantage of, and typically the person contacting us has use of the clip from in some other manner. Haven't inquired how.
Maybe you've already pointed this out, and I just wasn't focusing on it. But I mean, when you send a no objection letter, is that also essentially saying we have no objection to your circumventing CSS in order to make this clip?
No, we don't say that, and we haven't been asked that. We've never gotten a request to actually circumvent.
Okay.
Taking into account the demonstration that Fritz made of the camcording service, even if we want to set aside the need to circumvent. I mean, there are ways to get a clip that's of a usable quality, at least for, certain educator purposes, by using the camcorder solution that Fritz demonstrated. And so in that case, I would anticipate that the educator would simply make their own evaluation as to whether it's a fair use or not. Use the camcorder to make the clip, use it in their lecture, and we would never hear from them. So.
Okay, good. Sounds like we're done. Thank you very much for your patience and your help. For those of you who have the misfortune to have business before us tomorrow, we will see you at 10 o'clock in the morning.
10?
10. Isn't it 10, Rob?
10.
10.
Yeah, 10.
I've told it's 10.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.